Welcome to the Wealthy Speaker Podcast. This is the podcast dedicated to people who want to speak more as a way to build their income and grow their business. Well, welcome everyone to the Wealthy Speaker Podcast. I'm your host, Jane Atkinson, and the goal of this podcast is to help you catapult your speaking business. You know, at some point in my life, I used to say catapult your speaking career, but I've changed that to business because this is a business. And I think the more people treat it like a business, the better. And speaking of which, this podcast is brought to you by Accelerate Live 2018, which is a fabulous live event that we'll be putting on in Toronto, September 7th to 8th. And we'll be talking to the main things at this event about sales and stories. I'm going to be doing a deep dive on sales and the processes that will allow you to move through from lead all the way to getting the gig and the post engagement. We're having Kelly Swanson in to talk stories. She is hilarious, and I think she's going to do a terrific job talking to you about how to make your stories better and how to add more humor to your speech. And then two of my closest colleagues, Bob Parker and Greg Shankle, are going to be joining us to share their ideas on experiential trainings. That's Bob's specialty. He's been selling and running large ticket events for years. And Greg Shankle is going to talk to you about how you can win those seven-figure contracts. He has been just blowing it up out there. And I'm super excited to really dive deep into how you really sell such large contracts. It's going to be a great event, and people always leave these full of ideas and ready to take action. Go on over to speakerlauncher.com and click on events for more information about Accelerate Live 2018. Our guest today is Marilyn Sherman, and something super cool just happened to Marilyn last week in Dallas. And if I were to introduce her now, she actually has two sets of letters after her name, CSP and CPAE. And CPAE is basically the Speakers Hall of Fame. In the halls of the National Speakers Association, this is like the highest honor that one can achieve. Marilyn, it must have felt so great to be inducted into such a prestigious group. How do you feel about that?
I feel pretty fantastic. I'm not going to lie. It was a great weekend in Dallas, and I'm still high from it.
Yeah, and your birthday was after that, and there's just been a series of things that, you know, we've claimed this to be the year of Marilyn, and it sure seems like that is starting to come true. So we have so much to talk about, and rather than doing a formal bio, I'm just going to kind of talk through your career. The name of this podcast is From We'll Speak for Tacos to the Speaking Hall of Fame. So let's talk about the tacos.
Well, before I spoke for tacos, I saw a speaker that came to Mercer Island High School. I grew up outside of Seattle, and I was so inspired by this speaker, I decided that that's what I wanted to do with my life. So I'm one of those rare people who knew, literally knew, that this is my career path. So once I saw Roger Crawford speak, I started to go seek out speaking engagements. I bought Zig Ziglar audio tapes. I bought Tony Robbins audio tapes. I bought like my first conference I went to was called Self-Image Psychology by Dick Anderson. So before I even graduated from high school and on my way to college, I was already starting to plant the seeds of a career as a motivational speaker. And then I got my degree in sociology with an emphasis on psychology with the intention of going out into the business world, get a job in the business world. And my mission statement was to help people feel good about themselves so they do better work. Because I learned from those psychology classes and those speakers I went to, you always have to have a vision statement or a mission statement. So it started very early on, and my intention was to have credibility in front of business audiences by getting a job in a business environment. So my first job out of college was at the Seattle Crisis Center, I was answering suicide prevention hotline calls from midnight to 8. It was very gratifying. I was very good at it, but it wasn't part of my mission. So I got a job at a finance company and quickly moved up in the ranks of this finance company and then ended up in training and development. So that's where I learned about adult learning. I learned about putting on training programs. I learned how corporations work in terms of training their employees. Mm-hmm. And I went from there to a seminar company doing 6-hour seminars up to 5 cities a week, up to 3 weeks a month. And I did that for 5 years.
Serious road warrior.
Total road warrior status. And I moved to San Diego, California. And I was on the road with this seminar company. And then after 5 years, that's when I published my first book. I turned 35 and I quit my job because I had a gig. And I thought, this is all I need is one or two of these a month. And I'm going to be, this is fantastic. And as soon as I quit my job and celebrated with my birthday, so 35, so that was literally 20 years ago yesterday. I didn't get another gig for like 6 months. So I went through my 401k, I went through my savings, I went through everything. And so I've been hustling gigs one speech at a time ever since. So when I left that seminar company, one of the first, speaking of tacos, one of the first gigs I got was a Christmas party for Rubio's Fish Tacos. And they paid me $500 and $250 in cash and $250 in Rubio's Fish Taco gift certificates.
It sounds delicious.
They're so good. I mean, I discovered carne asada burritos and they were really good. And as a starving speaker, they really came in handy.
Right.
Plus at that very same time, I started a Power Up Breakfast for Professional Women, where another speaker and I collaborated and put together these public seminars. And I would do door prizes, and Rubio's Fish Tacos became a really fun door prize.
Oh, that's nice. So, and let's talk about the full circle moment of having the gentleman who hired you from Rubio's at your table.
Yeah.
He did hire you later on in life as well.
Well, Gabe Hostler has been a really great friend from Rubio's. He was there that night in 1998, and then he hired me again for CHART, which is the Council of Hotel and Restaurant Trainers Association. Mm-hmm. And then he brought me in to speak for Rubio's again in 2016. And I told him, I'm going to need a few more tacos.
The price has gone up.
Yeah, the price has gone up. So he's just so sweet and so fun. And so I invited him to come to Dallas to see me inducted into the Speaker Hall of Fame. So he sat at the table.
What a really, really cool full circle moment. And I was grateful to be able to share that with you and sit at your table. And even though you are my client, I just want to make it crystal clear that I had nothing to do with you getting inducted into the Speaking Hall of Fame. You and I will be responsible for the next 10 years, but the previous 20 before this, that was all you. I mean, you really deserve that honor, and it was amazing to see you be recognized in that way. Let's talk about your brand, Front Row Leadership, and how much that has had to do with kind of your clarity and your course over the last 2 decades.
Well, after working for the seminar company, and I saw Larry Winget speak at our NSA chapter, and he was talking about books, and he wrote a bunch of books, and he had a bunch of swag in the back of the room, and he was always selling stuff, and I looked at him and I said, oh, Larry, I've been working on my book for 10 years. I really want to finish my book. And he said, finish your damn book. No one's going to read it anyway. And that actually, in Larry Winget style, actually made a lot of sense. Because the way I took that was, when I get off stage, people want to take a piece of me home.
Right.
And so when they buy my book, they give me a hug, they get an autograph. I mean, it's part of the whole process. Mm-hmm. So whether or not they read it, you know, that shouldn't be my focus. At least that's at the time. So
you were probably trying to make it perfect.
I was trying to make it perfect. And So I let go of the perfection and I published my first book, and it was called Whose Comfort Zone Are You In? Okay. How to Lead the Life You Want and Be Happy Every Day. Okay. So it was a motivational book about stretching yourself out of your comfort zone without jumping into someone else's. Okay. So my whole, you know, circuit of speaking was all about that topic, and my clients loved me and they wanted more. And I'm like, well, that's all I got.
What am I going to do now?
What am I going to do next? So I needed a second keynote that was independent of the first one. And that's how my second book came. It was called Why Settle for the Balcony? How to Get a Front Row Seat in Life. Mm. And that was a deeper dive on where are you sitting in your life right now? You could either be in the balcony, general admission, or the front row. And balcony seats suck. General admission is just too average. Life is to be lived in the front row. Mm. And so I started speaking about that topic. And then someone said, they made it sound like I was being boastful about, you know, living your life in the front row and always being the center of attention. But in fact, all the leaders that I interviewed before I deliver this keynote, and I would ask them what their favorite front row seat was, some of the most successful leaders out there would answer, when I would see my team succeed, that's my front row seat. So mm-hmm. then I came up with the usher analogy.
Right.
And the usher, you know, think of a dark showroom in Las Vegas where you have an usher who has knowledge of the venue and a flashlight. And they look at your ticket and they say, follow me. And they lead you to the most direct path to your seat. And that, to me, is the ultimate role of a leader, is to usher people to their front row by knowing what their front row looks like and then leading them on the most direct path. So then it becomes a real... a sense of service and a sense of being a leader in such a way that you are illuminating the path for others just by how you live your life, just how you talk to each other, how you walk, how you interact with people, how you treat people when no one's watching. That to me is illuminating the path for others. So I actually had a client who wrote me a thank you letter and signed it from my new title, Head Usher. And that's when I really said, okay, I've got something here. Wow. So then I developed Front Row Leadership, How Top Performers Never Settle for Balcony Seats.
Right.
So that's my message. Mm-hmm. And it's working.
And being a great usher is a part of it. So, you know, we talk a lot over here about picking a lane. Mm-hmm. And you have really... you've not only chosen your lane, but your lane has, you know, it's evolved and shifted and changed. You came out onto the scene back when you were first speaking as a motivational speaker, because that's what we did back then.
Right.
That was a normal path to have taken. And then you kind of figured out, well, what is the actual outcome of the work that I do? Mm-hmm. Move that into, front row, and then the usher idea. These are really, really great ideas. Let's talk about the bucket list idea.
Oh, well, the bucket list, that came very unexpectedly. My father, who I was very close with, he died in 2016. And then I went through grieving process like any person would. Mm-hmm. And I woke up on the year after his death. So it was July 2017. And I happened to weigh myself. And I'm like, oh my gosh, I had gained 34 pounds in the year since my dad died. And I literally said out loud, why do I keep doing this to myself? Why do I keep putting holes in my own bucket list? Mm. And as soon as I said that out loud, I thought, oh my gosh, that'd be a great title of a book. Mm-hmm. And so I decided to write a book called Is There a Hole in Your Bucket List? Sort of a play on words for right. people that have a bucket list. And then Is There a Hole in Your Bucket, Dear Liza, that song. So I put those together and I sort of did this backwards process of writing a book. I came up with the title first. I went to... I think 99 Designs, and did a contest, and had all these designers come up with a contest or come up with their version of what my vision was. Mm-hmm. I narrowed it down to the top 10. I put it out on social media and got all my followers engaged and involved. Not only were they vocal in what title or what covers they really liked, but also they got really excited about my new book.
Right. Good one.
So then I narrowed it. Well, so there was a clear winner, but it was in blue. And some people said they didn't like the color. So I did a side-by-side book cover of blue and red and put it out there on social media again and got them to vote. And people were very vocal, but the red won.
Yeah.
And so now they're saying, great, can't wait to read the book. Well, I hadn't written the book yet. So in August, my girlfriend's got a huge house in La Jolla, and I always threatened her. I said, hey, if I ever want to do a writing retreat, can I do it at your house? And she's always said, hey, my house is your house. So I literally went to Coronado, California, beautiful house on the island, and I sequestered myself there for a week, and I wrote the book.
Wow.
And then I got an editor, and I sent it out for edits. And then my good friend over at Cracker Barrel, who had hired me before for an HR conference, I had a speech near her home office where I was going to be done at 10 o'clock in the morning. And I didn't have to fly out till later. So I called her and I said, hey, do you want me to do a lunch and learn it in your home office? And she said, well, what you got? I've already seen your front row talk. And I said, well, got this idea about a bucket list. And is there a hole in your bucket list? And she said, love it. So I practiced my keynote in October, and I had just written the book in August, and it was in edits, and she loved it, and her team loved it. So then I had it printed and sent out for preview to folks and got lots of, an editor is not a typesetter, so I learned my lesson there.
Yeah.
There were a ton of typos, so Jess Pettit, who I know you've interviewed before, she literally took the book that I sent her and made all the corrections in it and sent the book back to me. It was really, so that became my new version that I sent to my new typesetter. And then I sold it as a keynote. So, literally I wrote it in August and published it in, had it drop shipped to New York City for a client for a keynote and sold it in October. Wow. And then the final version came out in January. And that came about because I was sabotaging my own success. And it was one of my more personal books. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not easy to talk about how you sabotage your own success.
Sure.
But that vulnerability, I think, resonated with people.
And I think that vulnerability is part of, I don't know if it's always been a part of who you are. We've only known each other for a few, I mean, we've known of each other for 20 years, but we've really only been friends for a couple. And, you know, have you always shown that side of yourself, or did you feel like you needed to kind of show up as the perfect leader?
I think I've always shown up in a way that I wanted to be, and then I've always had a soft spot for the underdog because I've been the underdog in my life. Mm-hmm. So I've always had a soft spot. I didn't show it a whole lot. I just showed it through empathy and understanding.
Okay.
But to write about it, I mean, that was really vulnerable because my whole issue, especially with my weight, is that I always hated to gain weight and go on stage as a motivational speaker thinking that my audience is going to judge me. It's like, geez, can't she lose a few if she's such a motivational speaker?
Right.
But that was all in my head, really was all in my head. So when I opened up and talked about it in the book, I mean, I literally opened my kimono and said, this is my fear, and this is, you know, my shame, and this is my guilt, but here's how I can overcome it. It sort of released me of all the anxiety of what I was trying to be versus who I really was.
So, in a lesson for people who may be suffering from some version of imposter syndrome,
yeah,
I think they should know that they're not alone. that right. a lot of people think that they have to, you know, because you are a professional speaker, that does not mean you have to be a perfect human being.
Exactly.
On every way, shape, and form.
Exactly. Exactly. Now, I'm not going to go on social media and gripe and complain and be that kind of a person. But I'm also not going to be the one to, you know, think that my life is perfect all the time.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's part of my personality. Part of my personality is always I'm going to be on stage the same way I'm going to be off stage.
Yeah.
Because I am not someone to put on a persona. Like all of a sudden I have speaker voice. That's not me. So.
Let's back up to the idea that you actually, so tacos was your first gig, but you really seem to follow that path in down the road into food services. How important has that been to your career? Why do you think food services caught on for you so well?
Well, I filled out a call for proposal for the Women's Food Service Forum and they hired me. And then I was scheduled to do two events at this conference, but I didn't have any bookings before it. So I decided to go in a day early and see the lay of the land. So by the time I got in front of them, I would know the vibe of the conference. That's sort of what I do if I'm not already booked. And then 2 weeks before the event, another speaker, had an emergency, a family emergency, and she had to back out. And so the client hired me to cover for the breakout that she couldn't do. So what they didn't do is they didn't tell the audience that we're replacing this speaker with another speaker. So they had already hired me for Whose Comfort Zone Are You In? And so I submitted my Why Settle for the Balcony, How to Get a Front Row Seat in Life. So I told the client, I'm already going to be there, so utilize me. And so they did. Well, that day, the other speaker's picture was out in the hallway because they didn't even change the picture. So I'm in the hallway saying, hey, everybody, it's not her, it's me. Trust me, we're going to have a good time. And Karen Stutz, who was a senior executive at the time, she was planning on going to the executive session. But she saw me in the hallway inviting people to come into my session. And she's like, okay. And I hit it out of the park, right? There was so much buzz from that event that people were talking about it all night. So the next day for my session that I was scheduled for, there was probably about 700 people in the room and it was set for 500.
Wow.
Yeah. So that changed my career. That one speech changed my career because these people it was like I walked on water. They were like, oh, you know, and it was not a food service specific talk. It was my keynote.
Right.
But they loved it. And so a relationship with food service professionals began. So from that, I did three events in that one conference. I got 19 spinoffs from it.
19 spinoffs. I really want people to hear this because we preach about delivering epic. Obviously, you delivered epic in that first unexpected presentation.
Yes.
And that created the buzz, then the keynote, I guess it was then another session, not the keynote, and 19 spins.
Right. So then like Cisco hired me. They had like 35 houses around the country. They called them houses, or now they're called OPCOs. So they hired me for a bunch of them. McDonald's hired me for their women's event. Sodexo hired me. I mean, it was like all these people involved in the food service industry, whether it be manufacturing or restaurant chains or franchises. And again, it wasn't specific to their industry. It was specific to who they were as people. Mm. So it just happens to be that food service professionals like high energy, real content driven speakers. And so WFF noticed that their people loved me. So they brought me back again the following year. And then they brought me back again the following year. And they brought me back for 12 years in a row. So because of that, I had a niche in the food service industry. And then I wrote a book called Front Row Service for the restaurant industry. So it was consistent with my brand. Mm-hmm. And it was specific to them. And I just kept going and going. And so, and when those people leave their organizations and go to other organizations, they then bring me to their new organizations.
And what's interesting is that when you would post videos on LinkedIn, which we've talked about being a part of the strategy, mm-hmm. and you can see who is viewing these videos, it yeah. showed you large numbers in food yeah. service. Yeah. And so that's something that we continue to work on. Mm-hmm. over and over again, like rather than, okay, let me go and find three new industries, let's just continue right. down the path of food right. service.
Right.
Let's talk about right before you and I met, and you were working with an agency and that had gone well for a certain number of years. Just tell me a little bit about that.
Well, I did a showcase at IASB, and so I was finally in front of...
Let me say what that is. That's the International Association of Speakers Bureaus. So now you got in front of, and they do a showcase.
They do a showcase. It's a high-end showcase, but it immediately paid off because mm-hmm. I got work immediately from bureaus who did not know who I was.
Right.
And they were very excited, saying, wow, finally we have another female motivational speaker that we can promote. So mm-hmm. that was great. So right after that, I signed with an agency, which meant I was exclusive with them. Their phone number was on my website, and they handled everything. And I was with them for 5 years.
Okay.
And after 5 years, I decided I really missed the engagement and the talking with my customers. Mm-hmm. So I had turned all of that over to an agency, and I missed it, and I wanted that back. So so I left the agency in last September.
Right. And so there was a bit of a reinvention then again yeah. then to start kind of, because when you were done with them, they didn't have a lot of bookings on your calendar.
Right. I had to go back and remind the bureaus that they could come directly to me. They mm-hmm. didn't have to go through an agency. If they mm-hmm. needed anything, they could come to me. So my website has my phone number back on it. And yeah. so I had to reintroduce myself because I didn't know exactly how much promotion was done from the agency.
Right.
And I just assumed that they were talking about me all the time and, you know, connecting with bureaus all the time about me. But they represented seven other speakers too. So right. it wasn't a one-on-one situation. So instead of not knowing, well, how much promotion is going on out there and just assuming someone was, you know, putting my material out there, I had to take it back. So take then I was control. Really, you know, and my business had changed in the 5 years. So I have to take ownership of, okay, what's my message? Who's my target market? Who would I be the best fit for? Mm-hmm. And then go out and remind people of this is what I do and this is who I do it for best.
And you've been doing it amazingly for 20 years. And I think that even today, there are bureaus who could be adding you to their roster. And here's the complaint I've been hearing. Ever since I was with the bureau, which was a decade ago, we've always said that the industry doesn't have enough strong female business speakers. And so I feel like that's a big gap that you can fill for people. Right. And the fact that you're just continuing to reinvent yourself, it's not the material that you were delivering 10 years ago that you're right. delivering today. Mm-hmm. It's all fresh and new. And I think that that's really amazing.
All right. And I just had an Australian Speakers Bureau book me for an event coming up next week. And she said, I remember you from that IASB showcase. And that right. was years ago. Yeah. So it's really cool that people remember, you know, I mean, that's if you want to, you just need to be top of mind with people, but you also need to be memorable when you do get in front of them.
Right.
So that there's something about them that think, okay, as soon as I have a client that will be a good fit, I know who to call.
That's right. And going out and educating the bureaus and any other middlemen type groups on who you specialize in. Because if I'm the agent at the bureau and you say food services, I'm doing a mental ticker tape through my brain of all the clients I have in my database that might be a good fit for you. And I think that that's a part of our business, is just really reminding people and being in the right place at the right time.
Right.
When they're ready. When the call comes in from food service, you're okay. Yes, yes, yes.
Right.
Yes.
I also speak to women's conferences, and some people say there's no money in women's conferences. Oh, they've got money.
Not true.
So I'm speaking at a women's conference this fall, and I literally used a Scott Stratton line in that pre-call. I said, I was born to do this, which he said that. He said that on stage at NSA a couple years ago, and I've never forgotten that. And it's like, yeah, I totally was born to do this. And so when I was talking to this a committee where they were choosing their speakers for their women's conference, it just came out of my mouth because I truly believe that. Mm-hmm. Because women are a great audience because I give them confidence, I give them hope, I give them a strategy on how they can get to the front row of their life. They're very open to hearing my message. So I really love speaking at women's conferences as well.
That's great. Speaking of confidence, let's talk about raising fees and not staying at the prices that you had 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. How, it's a little bit scary to do that sometimes, is it not?
It's always scary to raise your fee because you've got clients who are used to paying a certain amount. Mm-hmm. So it does take you out of a certain pool and puts you into a different pool.
Right.
But there are customers who are like, send an invoice. There's no mm-hmm. question. Send an invoice.
And I think that the pool that you're in now is actually where there are a lot of really great engagements and the budgets are really high. And I think that that's a great spot for you.
Great. Tell your friends.
I will. And any bureaus who are listening in, let's give out the phone number. Actually, we'll put all the links in the show notes.
For other speakers that are listening to this, we really need to stand firm on our fee, because I had a huge client call me and say they saw me at the Women's Food Service Forum. They really wanted me. The date was available, and then they said, so what's your fee? And I stated my fee, and she said, oh, and then I immediately said, I know. If you've not hired speakers before, it's a little sticker shock, but hey, listen, I really want to work with you. So I will negotiate. And she said, no, I thought you would be much higher than that.
Oh.
So now I've learned to really just shut up.
Yeah. You know, say your fee and then be quiet. And I was just doing a little video about this on LinkedIn today about the fact that when we were, remember we did the little VIP party in our suite before the NSA convention started, and we had a bureau there, and she was talking about what her average booking fee was. Do you remember what she said, average booking?
No.
It was like 15 or higher. 15 to 20, I think, is what she said.
Uh-huh.
And everybody in the room went, oh. And it's because, I mean, I've been saying it for years that the budgets are really high. You know, Chris Young said that she would be given between $100,000 and $150,000 to spend on speakers for some of her big events. And I just think that people just don't really, they haven't really embodied that. They haven't really embraced the fact that, yes, people do have the budgets. And so you were ready to negotiate there. And she was like, you know, there's something about perception too. Mm-hmm. If you're too low in your fees, then that people will automatically think, oh, well, She's not in the league that I thought she was in.
And I did have a keynote, and I become friends with my clients. I mean, Stephanie LaRose is a good friend of mine. She hired me for a NACUFS convention, which is the National Association of College and University Food Service. Mm-hmm. And after she hired me for that keynote, she said, just by the way, your fee is too low.
Yeah.
We almost didn't hire you because of your fee.
Wow.
But I knew you would be a hit. So I convinced them that no, she's really good. But just FYI, you should raise your fee.
That is a really good thing for people to hear because, I know that people hear we don't have the budget, And so sometimes, you know, you get creative. How about if I throw some books into the mix? Will that help us tip over the, they can bring the budget in from somewhere else.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah. So, okay. So full circle moment. And there are five speakers inducted into the Speaker Hall of Fame. You also have your CSP, which is Certified Speaking Professional. And you headed up the committee to award the CSPs this year. Talk about what getting your CSP means if you are a member of the National Speakers Association. Just talk about that a little bit, and then we'll talk about Hall of Fame.
Well, the CSP is it's an internationally recognized designation to show that you have, in fact, have longevity in this business, because you have to prove you've earned at least $250,000 in speaking fees, a minimum over the last 5 years. Mm-hmm. And that your clients have sent in evaluations indicating that you've scored a certain number or above in terms of your professionalism and your ethics and your presentation skills. And then the next level is to have a peer review where your video that you submit, an unedited video of your work, is reviewed by four other speakers who are already CSPs. Mm-hmm. And then they rate you on a number, and then those numbers, you have to reach a certain number. And then once you do all that, then you are conferred by the National Speakers Association as being a certified speaking professional. So I chaired that committee this last year. And so Brian Walter, the president of NSA, he and I were on stage giving the medals to the people to congratulate them on their award. So it's a stamp of you've done it. You've done it. You're a professional. You've shown integrity. You've shown work ethic, you've shown business expertise, enterprise, eloquence, all those things that NSA stands for. So it's a nice, it's a designation that people really want because it puts them into another level. Not a lot of meeting planners know exactly what it is, but for the speakers, it's like, okay, the speakers that I admire have it and I want to do what they're doing. So I'm going to go and be in that pool of speakers so I can become better.
And lots of clients would know that, oh, okay, if they have their CSP, they've got experience. I think that's what the CSP stands for is, okay, they've been there, they've done it, you know, they've literally been awarded the medal.
Right.
Let's talk about a completely different award, which is called the CPAE, the Council of Peers Award of Excellence. Mm-hmm. And it, basically, you have been inducted into the Speakers Hall of Fame. I don't know how many people are in the Hall of Fame. Do you know the number?
I think the number is around 220, I think. And I think there's 180, 187 alive today.
Okay. So less than 200 people are in this really amazingly prestigious club, and you are a part of them. So I think that is just like the coolest thing. Like really. So you got up and you had how many minutes to give a speech? And let's talk about the speech, because that was
The speech was a lot of fun. Nito Quibane is my mentor. He endorsed my first book back in 1998, and he's always been so kind to me. I got to tell you, Jane, this is hilarious, because Nito Quibane is sort of like an icon in our industry. Mm-hmm. I sent him a copy of the book with a mock-up of the book cover, and he wrote me back with an endorsement, but he said, you may want to get an editor because you spelled the title of your book wrong. My book was called Whose Comfort Zone Are You In?
Yeah.
And between my typesetter and my editor and me, we all missed that whose should be spelled W-H-O-S-E. And I had sent it to him W-H-O apostrophe S.
Yes, wow.
And so we joked about it that it took a foreigner to correct me on my English. So we've always had a fun professional relationship ever since then. And then he owned his own magazine. So he said, hey, listen, let me give you some press, write an article for my magazine. And it went out to all of his business clients. So I always knew that if I ever got inducted into the Hall of Fame, I would ask him to be my introducer. And he did. And it was really moving because I didn't know what he was going to say. And I didn't know how long he was going to speak for.
Right.
Given 8 minutes, that's it.
So eight minutes, including introduction.
Including the introduction. So I figured, okay, maybe 2 minutes for him. And that gives me 6 minutes. So I planned on a 6 minute speech. And he spoke for about 3, and luckily the clock went down. I was over time, but luckily the music didn't come on.
Oh, that's good.
Well, it was a very special night. I'm not going to lie. It was a very special night.
I thought you would be a lot more nervous and a lot more emotional, and you held it together. I mean, really, it could have gone into the ugly cry at a couple of different moments.
Every time I practice, I cried.
Yeah.
Every time I practice, I cried. And I told Nino, I said, Nino, I don't want to cry. And he goes, well, take out the parts that make you cry. And I said, well, then it's going to be boring. So Bill Staten, whom I love,
he's
got 29 Emmys to his name. He's a comedy writer, and he's also a phenomenal keynote speaker. He and I had dinner the night before, and I just read him my speech.
Yeah.
Said, that's a great speech, but let's change it up a bit. And let's take out some chunks because it's too long and we don't need those details. So he helped me massage it and turn it into the speech that it was. And so once I had the speech down, then I was confident and I didn't cry.
And I had fun with it. And what I think was important about it, you know, a lot of acceptance speeches are just a list of people and that type of thing. But you really built in some really amazing story to your speech. Now, I wrote a piece on the power of community, which will have come out by the time we broadcast this, I think. But I wanted to hear it from your own words about the story about your dad.
Wow.
So can you get through it?
Yes. So my dad, again, hero, when he was dying of cancer, he literally was searching for a document in his home office to prove that he purchased a plaque that would go next to a bench that he commissioned at Lee Parkway, right outside of his condominium. He lived at the Mayfair in Dallas, in Turtle Creek. Mm. So he could see outside of his window people playing on this Benjamin Franklin bench. And he loved Ben Franklin, and he believed in, you know, the founders of our country, and he wanted our youth to know who the founders of our country were. So he had this bench commissioned, and it was a Benjamin Franklin bench, but they never installed the plaque. Now, think of this. You have months to live. Right. How do you spend your life?
Right.
I was visiting my dad a week at a time every month, and it broke my heart to see him going through paperwork, searching for proof that he had purchased the plaque. And so his wife and I went to the, you know, the condominium complex, the park people, and they kept saying, no, 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 no. And I'm like, okay, I don't want to pull the dying is on his deathbed wish card, but I gotta pull out the death card. Right. And they did nothing for me, nothing. Yeah. So I casually mentioned that to a good friend of mine, Tim Durkin, who I served on the CSP committee with, who was part of the North Texas chapter of NSA. And he mentioned it to the president at the time, Chris Price. And literally within a week, that plaque was installed next to my dad's bench.
Wow.
And then Michael Hoffman came. You and I know Michael Hoffman. We love Michael Hoffman. He came to visit, and we literally took my dad outside in a wheelchair. So the last time he went outside, he could see his plaque by his bench. So the reason why I tell that story is because the community of NSA is so deep. It's not just about, well, I don't get any business from NSA. Well, that is not why you join NSA. It's a community of people who care about each other and care about each other's lives, and they help each other grow. So I wanted to mention that story because we were in Texas, because North Texas chapter was going to be there, and because we were in Dallas, and it just meant so much to me that they were able to make my dad's dying wish come true.
Yeah, that's really special. And we know, I know how important dads are to daughters. You know, yeah. I certainly have the same kinds of stories with my dad. And it's really amazing, the power of community. And that's, so I wrote a piece about it. I'll run it past you to just make sure I got all the facts of the story correctly.
Well, but, not only that, Jane, but coincidentally, I was speaking at Rubio's Fish Tacos the day that my dad died. Mm. And so Eve was with me, my husband, Frenchie. He was with me in San Diego, and he took away my phone so I wouldn't get any notifications. So I went to speak for Rubio's and then came back to the room, and that's when Eve told me. And because Eve knew in the middle of the night. So he wanted me to be focused on my keynote for Rubio's. Right. So
there's nothing you can do at that point.
There's nothing I can do. Right. And he didn't want me to be emotional during my speech. So I literally went from San Diego to Phoenix, where the NSA convention was, Influence 2016, and I spoke at Influence. I did a breakout session. So people were hugging me, and it was my birthday too. So it was like, wow, are you hugging me because it's my birthday, or is it because my dad just died? You know, it's right. like, And so when I got up to speak, Lori Guest was there, and she said, listen, don't look at the slide, because I have a slide of a fallen soldier, and I would talk about American Airlines putting on a flag around this coffin, and it's about how we appreciate where we are in life, and not, you know, you can't walk in gratitude and sit in self-pity at the same time. That's a story that I tell. And then I said, by the way, this fallen soldier is now my dad, because I updated the picture. And so I told Lori Guest ahead of time, who's a dear friend. I said, Lori, I don't want to lose it. I want to make it through this. And she said, don't look at the slide. Look at me. I'm right here. Just look at me. And then I forgot to look at her because I saw Bill Staten, and I made a joke about Bill Staten not having his CSP yet. And we just all laughed. And it was, So I was surrounded by my NSA community, which I literally had to leave the next day to eulogize my dad. Mm. So I had so much love and care and compassion. And so I said that in my acceptance speech, you know, if you time it right, if you're going to lose someone, lose them right around an NSA convention, mm-hmm. so surrounded by the people who love and care about you.
It's so, you know, it's just such a warm embrace. And especially even people who don't know, they want to know what's going on with you. And it feels like a really nice safe space to talk.
But it's also what you put into it. You know, I'm involved. I serve on committees. I volunteer. I show up. I don't do that for the recognition, and I don't do that for the business. But that's a nice little benefit that happens as a result of giving back to a community that you love so much.
Yeah. Yeah. And you and I are both over two decades in this organization, and the connections are deep. That was what I wrote in my journal the morning I went out into the hallways of NSA, meaningful connections, you know, because you know how sometimes you just stand there talking to somebody about, yeah, what's going on with your business? Oh, not too much. What's going on with yours? And I thought, no, I'm not going to have those kind of mundane, ordinary conversations. I just really wanted to have something more meaningful. And I did. I felt really, really good about our time at NSA.
Yeah.
Well, Marilyn Sherman, CSB, CPAE, it has been an absolute pleasure having you on the Wealthy Speaker Show. And I think part of the lesson for today's show is that it's not necessarily just, you know, when we define the wealthy speaker, we're putting a whole bunch of things into the bucket.
Yeah.
It's not just about the bank account. It's not just about the number of engagements on your calendar. It's about the connections that you're making, and over the decade or two long history that you've had affecting people's lives.
Yes. And also, Jane, I used to chase. I used to be one of these people that chased main stage appearances, and I chased recognition, and I chased acknowledgement, and I chased to be in the cool kids club. You know what? I decided I was going to stop chasing. And as soon as I stopped chasing, these things showed up in my life. So that's a huge point. And I think, you know, maybe another time we can talk about, you know, my visit to a monastery on my stiletto summit in France. But, you know, I met a woman who she's dedicated her entire life to prayer and contemplation on top of a mountain. And after seeing the beauty and the joy and the pure unconditional love of this woman, it emanated from her every cell. I was so moved by that. I thought, you know what? I've been living too small of a life. Mm. And when you are seeking things like recognition and acknowledgement, that's playing small. So my intention is much bigger now. My intention is to touch more lives. My intention is to serve these 22 kids who are homeless, and I serve on their after school board. You know, that's when I serve the purpose and I put faces to the names of my purpose, then it doesn't matter how many gigs a year I do.
Hmm.
And that's been a recent shift. And I think that's showing up all of a sudden in these external ways that I used to chase and I don't chase anymore, mm-hmm. but now they're there. So go figure.
I'm so glad that you brought that up, because I think that understanding what mode you're in can be really, really helpful in coming at things from a place of service.
Mm-hmm.
That can be a really, really nice shift for people. So thank you for sharing that. And maybe we will have you on another time to go deeper into your France monastery visit, because I think that sounds really interesting. That could be an episode all on its own.
Yeah, that was life-changing. That was life-changing. Yeah.
Well, Marilyn Sherman, thank you so much for being on the Wealthy Speaker Show. I hope that you all have gained some ideas from this. And if you're listening to us in iTunes or Stitcher or Google Play, please leave us a review. Let us know if you've appreciated what you're learning on the show. And everything that we've talked about will be in the show notes. And with that, we will say, see you soon, Wealthy Speakers. Bye for now, everyone.
Thanks for listening to The Wealthy Speaker Show. Please visit speakerlauncher.com for your free Wealthy Speaker audit, and visit speakerlauncher.com/podcast for show notes and many more resources to help you catapult your speaking business. See you soon, Wealthy Speakers.